I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. When Scott Timberg, an arts reporter for the Los Angeles Times, was laid off in 2008, he wasn't alone. U.S. News & World Report found that 250,000 jobs in publishing and journalism were lost during the Great Recession. Scott Timberg argues that economic strain, the internet, and shifting social values are wiping out the middle and working class segments of the creative class, the musicians, architects, artists, and writers who create and disseminate culture. How do you make a living from art and culture in a high-tech, warp-speed, winner-take-all society? What will happen if art becomes a luxury? Scott Timberg on The Assault on the Creative Class, after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us, making Midday part of your day on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick and Hagerstown, and also broadcasting to the Eastern Shore of Maryland and Ocean City through WYPO and online through WYPR.org. According to artsjournal.com, since 2000, 80% of art reporters and critics for print publications have lost their jobs, 80%. Last year, the Los Angeles Times reported that from 2007 to 2014, Hollywood studio musicians saw their incomes cut in half. In 2012, Georgetown University had a survey that found that of all college graduates, architecture majors were most likely to be out of work. 14% of architecture students who were by then 22 to 26 years old were unemployed. Reporters, critics, musicians, architects all fall into a definition of the creative class used by Scott Timberg, a culture writer for Salon, in a new book called Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class. Along with record store clerks, bookstore workers, dancers, and others, the creative class creates and disseminates art, contributing to how we view and experience the world. But the forces of the economic slowdown following the Great Recession, the internet, and changing social values are squeezing middle and working class members of the creative class. Rent in cities is soaring, jobs are disappearing, and only the populace seem to succeed. So how do you make a living from art and culture in a high-tech, warp-speed, winner-take-all society? What price will our society pay when artists can't make a living at all? What will happen to our culture if art becomes a luxury? To help us answer these questions, we're joined by the L.A.-based culture writer Scott Timberg. He is a contributing writer for Salon, as I mentioned. He's also written for the New York Times, GQ, and The Hollywood Reporter. He co-edited the anthology, The Misread City, New Literary Los Angeles, a profile of the city's literary and publishing scene. And more of Scott's writing can be found at Art Journal's Culture Crash blog. Most importantly, I should mention that Scott Timberg was an arts reporter for the L.A. Times. He was laid off in 2008. He was one of the 80% that I mentioned there of art reporters and critics for print publications who lost their jobs since 2008. Scott, welcome to Midday. Nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Yeah, thank you for writing this book. And it's a really interesting topic that affects a lot of people. You're not just talking about struggling, starving artists, you know, the classic bohemian in his garret cold because he can't afford fire for the fireplace. This is in the modern age. It covers all kinds of people. Richard Florida had a definition of the creative class that went beyond yours, though.
Yeah, Florida's a little bit different, but you know, I appreciate you mentioning the starving artist. I mean, you know, we've had a couple hundred years that goes back to the 19th century in France was where that sort of myth came up. A couple hundred years where we've thought of the artist in sort of two ways that are basically deceptive and sort of dangerous. One is, you know, the sort of, well, we're in Baltimore here, so I can mention Edgar Allan Poe and point out that sometimes it really does happen, right? You know, mm-hmm. Sometimes a genius is misunderstood, drinks too much, passes out in an alley, you know, overdoses on absinthe. You know, that does exist, but that's become the way we see artists. The other way we see them is the sort of heroic, you know, Michelangelo, you know, Rolling Stones in the 70s, you know, figure where the artist is this wealthy superstar. And these people do exist in some ways.
In Florida's definition, I say went beyond yours. He included in all of this people who are working in the digital world, for instance.
Exactly.
A professional class of the creative class.
Yeah, I mean, Florida includes, you know, pharmaceutical engineers. I think he includes mm-hmm. lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, even people in finance. I mean, you know, it may make some sense, but it didn't make sense to me. I wanted to look at people who worked in culture at some level, whether it was, you know, an architect or a jazz soloist on one hand, but also people at a bookstore, somebody writing about music for a newspaper. These are all part of the same ecology. So I mention this sort of dichotomous high-low thing because really the culture, the creative class in general is really a subset of the middle class. They have been for decades. And when the middle class gets hammered the way it has been, the creative class pays a price as well.
As people who made a living being creative, it included photojournalists in that as well.
Yeah.
So your
absolutely.
Definition for the purposes of this book and this show, mm-hmm. that's going to be narrower than Florida's was.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're looking just at this subset. Now, some people may have heard me reference you as having been laid off at the LA Times during the wonderful Sam Zell era when he owned the Tribune
Good Times
operation
yeah, right.
that included the LA Times and the right. Baltimore Sun.
Right.
So are you bitter?
Well, I don't know. I don't think I'm bitter, and I don't think I'm, you know, depressed by the people talk about my book. They say, well, it's interesting, but am I going to be depressed by it? And, you know, for a lot of us who work in culture, work in journalism, musicians, et cetera, it isn't depressing because this is the world we know. This is the world we live in. And, you know, individual temperaments vary. I have friends who have lost jobs, who've had their marriages destroyed, who had an architecture firm that doesn't exist anymore, who are really depressed, and they should be. I'm not. I don't. I'm more interested in figuring out where we go next. But I think to look forward and figure how to get out of this ditch, we need to understand the problem. We need to understand the conditions that brought us here. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book. It was, to me, like a sort of murder mystery. What the hell happened? What brought us to this point? We need to understand it in all its dimension.
Okay. That's part of my thanks for you for doing this. Let's start with two big factors. The economy, I mean, this started before the Great Recession, as you point out in the book. But we can talk specifically about what happened during this, I don't know, the last 10 years or so, and also about the internet. Let's tackle those two subjects first.
Yeah, well, you know, I think of my book as the crisis I'm describing has sort of three main elements. One is the economy. The recession was a kind of bold-faced version of it, but the march of inequality goes back to the 70s. It was heightened by the Reagan Revolution and by deregulation and things like that. But the recession was a big part of it. I should point out that during the supposed recovery, median income, so basically the middle class, you know, wages has gone down. It's not just been the market crash of 08. It's been almost a decade, and things weren't looking great for the middle class before then either. The internet, the coming of digital technology was another big issue, and a more abstract thing, which I call social norms and sort of the evolution of ideas, sort of shifting ideas of what art is and what people who make it are like, is a third element. But the most tangible things are the economy and the internet. So this isn't the internet is bad book by any means. They're wonderful books like that. Nicholas Carr's The Shallows, Jaron Lanier's book. Astra Taylor has a great book called The People's Platform. But, you know, so the internet and digital technology, you know, like any kind of technological shift, does good things and bad things. My concern is what it does to the creative class. And I probably don't have to tell people in Baltimore. I can certainly say, living in L.A., there are bookstores, record stores, video stores, just to pick, you know, sort of street level example, that used to be in my city, in my neighborhood, where I used to hang out, used to meet people who shared my passion for these things, artists and writers, some cases sort of on their way up, you know, people like Patti Smith, Lucinda Williams, Tom Verlaine of the band Television, the lead singer of the Decemberists, Jonathan Lethem, the novelist, worked at a bookstore in Berkeley. All kinds of people who were trying to make it as artists and writers apprenticed at these places. They wanted to be around the stuff. You know, they're so passionate. I worked myself at the Tower Records in Annapolis, which post-college in the first Bush recession. That was an unpleasant time in some ways. But being around the music, being with people who are passionate like me was a blast. And I've learned a ton from the people who've worked in these places. So the internet has done some good things and bad things. It's put these places out of business, Amazon in particular. It's not alone. When you compete, when you have an online company that doesn't have a brick and mortar space, and in the case of Amazon, doesn't have to pay sales tax and things like that, that a real shop does, you have unfair competition, and these places get crushed. And part of the reason I wrote this book and interviewed bookstore clerks and record store clerks is these people and these institutions matter to me. They're part of the same arts economy that a symphony or a magazine is a part of.
You mentioned Tower. You mentioned Borders, the bookstore chain also. And I throw in Video Americaine, which was a very popular video store.
Yes,
forever.
Yes. You know, I know people who lament that one too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the street level stuff we're talking about. It's important. Yeah. Also, when it comes to the internet and print journalism, photojournalism, all of that. Scott, I don't have to tell you, you probably have this experience. People will say, even when you worked at the LA Times, they'll say, you know, that paper isn't what it used to be. Or why should I pay for the newspaper when the newspaper is online? That goes for magazines as well.
Yeah.
And talk about a shifting landscape. This is serious stuff. You had the explosion of Craigslist there that just...
Right.
I literally mean an explosion. This was an explosion that went off in the great building of newspapers in America saying, what happened? We lost all that classified advertising, that revenue, and then the recession hit. So what do you say to people when they complain about journalism today or their thin newspaper?
Yeah, well, you know, they're right. I mean, you know, newspapers are incredibly diminished from where they were in the 90s or early 2000s. I'm a newspaper reader and a sometimes newspaper writer. I feel it too. It's terrible what happened. It wasn't because the people who work at newspapers wanted to fire their colleagues and have to work harder and everything. I mean, there were a bunch of things. I mean, corporate ownership didn't help. I mean, you mentioned the Tribune years. That wasn't going to end well. Those people didn't really know what they were doing. It's quite clear. Many of them walked away with multi-million-dollar golden parachutes, I should add, while the rest of us went into foreclosure and unemployment. But the corporate turn that newspapers took was, in the long run, a dangerous one. But when you have when you have news for free, I mean, it's basically the whole sort of cult of free. I mean, it's a information wants to be free. There's a sort of Silicon Valley rallying cry, you know, that information wants to be free. If that's true, then how do you support professionals? I mean, if you want everything, you know, music, journalism, architecture, let's say doctors and lawyers, maybe they should be amateurs too. I mean, if you just want everything to be open and free and not have any credentialing and not have any institutions and not have people actually making careers and apprenticeships and all the traditional stuff, if you think that's just some stuffy 19th century idea, then, you know, you're going to really like the next 20 years. And without newspapers and reporting, corruption both by the state and corporations will just be more and more rampant.
Address this for me, would you? That even though there's been this incredible downsizing in journalism in America in all forms, television as well, local TV, radio, all of it, print especially, people will look at the internet, they'll look at Twitter today, and they'll say, what do you mean there's plenty of news, there's plenty of things to read out there, we're covering the world, aren't we?
Sure. And you know, certainly on the big, whatever the big, you know, sort of foreign policy disaster is, you'll have a lot of reporters out in whatever the war zone is. But corruption and things that we need journalists for happen everywhere. They especially happen in state houses. And if you look at the number of reporters covering the state house in New Jersey, Maryland, California, whatever, that's been cut in half, and in some cases more. The Bridgegate in New Jersey, for instance, you know, that city hall is not getting covered the same way. Would we be able to catch Enron now if it's a sort of new arrangement? I don't think so. I'll also point out that the internet does disseminate information, but the ethics and the internet is disseminates information and misinformation. I mean, there was a study the other day showing that something like 51% of Republicans think there were weapons of mass destruction, you know, an active program in Iraq, and something like 40% of of Democrats. We had people who believed nonsense before the internet came in, but the percentages have never been higher. I mean, all kinds of crazy conspiracy theories and flat earth nonsense disseminates on the internet, and it looks just like the real stuff. With newspapers and traditional print media, for all their faults, they weren't perfect, it was a lot clearer what was reported and sound and what was kind of loony bin material. And that those categories have broken down on the internet.
You make the comment in the book with regard to the internet and the tools that are available to people. People are satisfied with good enough. What do you mean?
Well, good enough is, you know, exists in all kinds of ways. I mean, musicians, Neil Young is one example, will complain about the quality of sound when it's compressed into an MP3 file. You know, he's right. I mean, if you're listening to everything on a digital file through headphones or, you know, at your desk and your computer, you're not getting the full experience of music that these people work so hard to produce. But good enough also works for journalism and information, too. I mean, if all you're doing is reading headlines and maybe summaries of stories, summaries of a review of a film, you're not really engaging with this stuff. You're just sort of letting it wash over you. And you know, maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I think an actual connection to the world is better than a sort of superficial surfing.
Scott Tim Berg is our guest in this hour of the show. If you'd like to join our conversation, please chime in at 410-662-8780. Culture Crash is Scott Tim Berg's book, The Killing of the Creative Class. If you have reflections to share with us, please give us a ring. Our toll-free long-distance number is 866-661-9309. The Midday email address is midday@wypr.org. Use your creative talents to send us an email with comments if you like. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Scott Tim Berg with us. His book, Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class. You still continue to write about arts and culture, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how are you doing? I mean, obviously, you published a book. That's good for you. But, I mean, how is your life? How is your working life today?
Well, you know, I've gone through the same transition that a lot of journalists have gone. I've gone from, you know, working for a print publication and to writing primarily for the internet. And there's lots of opportunities to get your stuff, no matter who you are, whether you're a professional, a student, an amateur, online. The problem is, though, that when print advertising was undercut, the whole infrastructure, you know, those of us who were reporters didn't really know this because we were kept away from that side, I think for good reason, because you wanted to keep the business and the ad people away from the people doing the reporting and the writing. But when print advertising was undercut, the money in journalism was slashed to ribbons. So those of us who write primarily online, which is what I do, I mean, I sometimes write for the LA Times, New York Times, but primarily if you're writing online, you're making like a half to a tenth of what you used to. And, you know, I'm not going to be able to keep it up much longer. It's fun, but it's no longer a profession for me.
People who worked in that profession in the last decade and took buyouts or were laid off, lost their jobs, or students who thought about going into journalism, who actually studied it in college and then found that there were no jobs there, where did they go? Do you think they went elsewhere in the creative class, or do you think they went outside of the creative class to find work?
You know, I think a little of both, but, you know, the people I've spoken to and know, some of them have sort of bounced back and have, you know, they might have lived in a home before and you know, been comfortable and secure. Now they're kind of in transition. I think there's a lot of us who sort of have a 3-month plan or something. You know, again, the recession is supposedly long over. All the nastiest stuff happened years ago. A lot of us are still floating. It's kind of hard to know where we're going to end up. The makes it hard to plan. Obviously, it's tough on families if you have kids in school. It's hard to commit to doing things like teaching or anything if your whole life is kind of lived in sort of lived month to month. I think that's where a lot of people are right now.
You refer to in the book the gig economy. There's a lot of this in all forms of art.
Yeah, and you know, the if this was a you know, if we lived in a country with a really strong safety net and you could sort of take chances and know that there was something built in to save you, which is incidentally the way banks operate. You know, they can do whatever they want and our tax money will bail them out if they screw up. But for most of us, that's not the case. Until recently, you didn't even have medical insurance accessible to you if you were an independent writer, artist, independent anything. So there's been this funny kind of, again, this sort of Silicon Valley ideology that that connects with a kind of libertarian kind of Ayn Rand kind of silliness, which is that, you know, if you, you can be this sort of rugged individualist and go off on your own, and it's better than just being some sort of gray flannel suit, you know, company man. And there's part of me that, responds to that. I mean, sure, everybody likes individualism. America has kind of doubled down on it as part of our identity on the world stage. But if you look at this kind of squarely in the eye, you see that in a country without a strong safety net, where you don't have, you know, union protection or an institution supporting you, a few people are going to make it. Most people will struggle and lead unstable lives. And the few people, like, say, a musician like Amanda Palmer, say, who find a way to build a following online, you will hear about them incessantly. And I don't mean to knock these people. They're often very innovative and smart, but they will become the Horatio Alger stories of the 21st century, the same way that those operated in the last Gilded Age. That's what you hear about. That's the way these internet heroes exist in the 21st century.
And the story
century.
You don't hear is the one you're telling in the book.
Yeah,
the loss of the middle class. I want to emphasize this for our audience.
Yeah,
you are talking
crucial
about,
to the book. Yeah.
You're talking about working class, middle class, creative people. You're not talking about Kanye West or
right.
James Cameron, the filmmaker,
right.
way
right.
up in that strata.
Right. I don't worry about them the same way I don't worry about Donald Trump.
Right,
yeah.
right. You're talking about people who once actually made a living
right.
Doing creative things.
Yeah, and that's the vast majority of the creative class. And that's as I went through this weird, you know, being knocked on my back, and I found so many other people who were animators or writers or journalists or whatever going through it too. That's the story I wasn't hearing. I was sort of seeing it in the real world, but I wasn't reading about it in magazines and newspapers. It wasn't part of the conversation after and it wasn't part, and helping these people because we didn't recognize the crisis wasn't part of the conversation either. Detroit got saved. The banks got saved. You know, our tax money went to give the guys in AIG enormous benefits. There was no talk about saving people in the creative class.
And the thought was, the belief was, the hope was, the wishful thinking was that the internet would save you. That, okay, things are shifting, it's changing, people aren't going to read books anymore, they may not hold newspapers in their hands, but don't worry, there's going to be a need for people to provide content, to create what we see and read.
Yeah, I mean, American optimism is valuable in some ways, but it did become this sort of magical thinking lie. I mean, there's a lot of internet hype that, you know, the net will save us. Now you're set free to plot your own course. You know, it was, again, a sort of Reaganite, you know, rugged individualist thing. But, you know, let's look at the important work that's coming out right now. I mean, you know, recently, the D'Angelo record, the best soul record in a long time, came out a month or so ago. We have a record by Sleater-Kinney, the great indie rock band, Belle and Sebastian. The Decembers have a new one coming. Richard Linklater's Boyhood is a very profound and unconventional film. Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel. All this stuff, the most significant new work in their fields, are made by people who broke in the old world, in the 90s, and in a sort of indie world that was independent-minded but also involved institutions. That world is gone. There's not an equivalent movement in independent film, for instance, of people a generation older than Wes Anderson and me. Gen Y is not able, the infrastructure just isn't there to make serious character-based films anymore.
So I guess the question would be, what are we losing? What have we lost? What do you see as the problem here? I don't want to take for granted that everybody understands what it is. You have to kind of articulate it.
Yeah, I mean, again, there's so many things coming together. It's hard to unravel, you know, which of these things are cyclical, which of them are recession, which are, you know, there's so many different waves. It's like having nine planets running around and trying to, you know, plot what's going on. I mean, but here's the key point of my book. It's not that art and culture is going to stop tomorrow. You know, my main point is that when artists and craftsmen can't make a living, we all pay the price. I mean, if I may quote misquote David Byrne, who grew up in Baltimore and went to Maryland Institute, I think, before going to RISD and forming the Talking Heads. You know, he said, if musicians can't make a living, they won't be able to do this. if it's not a profession anymore, it's something that amateurs and only amateurs will do, people who are not choosing to commit their lives to things. And that's not just true of musicians. I mean, how many parents are now telling their kids, I mean, I'm one of them, and I hope I bounce out of this, but how many parents are telling their kids, go to law school, son or daughter, you know, go to med school, don't do this. People will be able to work in culture if they have trust funds, but I don't think that's really a culture. You know, I want a culture that middle-class people can enter into. Again, maybe it's just working at a bookstore or something. Not everybody is talented enough to make a living as a professional filmmaker or musician, but there used to be ways that middle-class people could break in and commit a life to culture. That's what we're losing, and to me, that's a serious loss.
You mentioned music a number of times there. How we get our music today is something you address in the book, and some people think, well, Steve Jobs made a good deal for musicians, and now we have Spotify and Pandora, and there's all this music out there, and people who are in a garage band someplace in Dundalk can get access to the internet, and somebody in Paris can listen to them. This is all very cool.
Sure. Right? All true. And, you know, I'm in a garage band. We play, like, sort of early Bowie, Neil Young, Wire, Clash. It's a lot of fun. And we're able to put it online, and our friends can listen to it. Believe me, you do not want a world that's dominated by bands like mine. I mean, I have a lot of fun doing this. Musicians need to make money for their work if they're going to stay with it. A band in Dundalk that, you know, is able to stream their stuff essentially for free will do it for a couple years, and then it's over. They're going to need to get day jobs. Again, if we have a country with a safety net that allows, you know, artists to you know, supports artists and independent people, it'd be different, but we don't. In my city, Los Angeles, you know, the average rent for a two-bedroom is something like $2,400 a month. I think I have that right. In the Bay Area, it's worse. In New York, it's worse. In a lot of cultural centers, it's getting more. The rents are going up by 10% or more a year. So again, if musicians don't need to make money, or journalists don't need to make money, or novelists don't need advances, this would all be great because it is easier to get work out. But if they're not getting paid, they're going to stop doing it unless they're independently wealthy. And I don't want art just to be made by rich kids and celebrities.
What about Kickstarter, crowdfunding? Isn't this working out for people?
You know, there's a lot of enthusiasm around those. Indiegogo, which is used by a lot of independent filmmakers, is I think those are making a good difference. Some serious people have used them. There's also a lot of nonsense, like designing, really fancy watches and stuff. But there's some good work that's come out of that. I think that's a bright spot. To me, it's a little like, you know, the revival of vinyl record stores. You know, it's great. You know, some money gets put into the arts economy. It employs a handful of people. But vinyl sales are, you know, like, I don't know, 1 or 2%, a tiny fraction of what the revenues for the music industry. It's nice. It doesn't solve the problem, though.
Scott Timberg is our guest, former arts reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He writes on music and culture and contributes to Salon and the New York Times. This book is called Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class. It's published by Yale University Press. And by the way, the jacket design has also got a local connection, too,
yes,
right?
Yes, well, one of my best friends from elementary school and high school, Evan Gaffney, went to Maryland Institute and designed the book jacket of this, which I'm very happy about. So, absolutely, yeah.
We'd like to hear from members of the creative class, the working creative class, or maybe the unemployed creative class. Give us a ring. After this short break, we'll come back and take some calls for Scott Timberg. 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. Coming up in midday's second hour, from James Bond to Jason Bourne, a look at American cinema during the Cold War and since then. How what we saw at the movies changed from the time of the Soviet Union to the age of terror and cyberspace. Midday on Film with DeLibero and Reed and special guest Bryn Upton from McDaniel College. That's coming up after the news at 1. We'll be right back. comment on my Facebook page from one of our listeners, Sean, who says, this topic of everything for free hits home for me as a freelance photographer. Recently, I had photographed my local state delegate, just a simple headshot for his latest campaign. A few months later, in the heat of the election, I got some anti-Democratic mailers shoved in my mailbox. These ads used my headshots of my delegate without having my permission to do so. After spending some time tracking them down, I sent them an invoice for usage fees. They scoffed and claimed that because it's on the internet, it's free. They were most definitely wrong. After a few months, they ended up paying me about a third of what the work was actually valued at. I got lucky. There is little resource for freelancers like me to take large companies to court for stealing their work and refusing to pay. Something needs to change.
That's, you know, I wish I could say I was surprised by that. That kind of thing is going on in every art form. It's absolutely true. For a journalist, it happens as well. Your stuff gets picked up and passed around without anything getting back to you. And you're the person who spent the time, you know, photographing something, buying equipment for your camera, or reporting a story, writing it. That's happening in every art form, and it's terrible. What he says about independent artists and corporations is absolutely right. I mean, that's why we need some kind of movement or some kind of unity among artists. There's a group that that I respect called Content Creators Coalition that's trying to unify photographers, writers, musicians, indie filmmakers, et cetera, because we can't stand up on our own against these big Silicon Valley tech companies or Wall Street or any of the other huge corporations that control our lives.
Scott Timberg is our guest in this hour of the show. Culture Crash is his book, The Killing of the Creative Class. Mike in North Baltimore, thank you for holding to comment here. Welcome to the show.
Sure. Well, the conversation continued to be interesting. And hello, Dan. Hello, Scott Timberg. And I look forward to checking your book out because I like this topic. I'm not sure I have a question. I do have a question in the sense, do you think you'll be able to afford yourself to be able to continue to push the investigation or the organizing you just referenced just now about pushing ahead? But I also would end just with a comment that the Station North Arts District initiative in Baltimore seems to be moving against the grain, and I point that out. But I'm finding that one of the establishments has live music, some interesting bands, four nights a week without a cover charge. Liam's Flynn Alehouse. I don't have any stock in it. I'm just a passersby, right. So I note that particular initiative, but I'm wondering, do you see yourself being able to push forward in terms of having this topic stay on the front burner?
You know, you're the second or third person who's mentioned that sort of neighborhood movement to me today. So
it's not far from here.
Yeah, right. We just drove past it, and it seems like it's something that's. I mean, look, there are good things happening around the edges. Don't get me wrong, and I think particularly Baltimore, a city which has respected arts, serious arts institutions that go way back, and also has a cost of living that's much different and less brutalizing than a New York, a San Francisco, Los Angeles, et cetera. As for me, I sure hope so. I mean, this is something that I take seriously. Obviously, it took me almost 4 years to write this book. I'm going on radio and sort of barnstorming as best I can to get the word out. It's not just going to be, and how long I can keep doing it. You know, again, it comes down to sort of pragmatic financial stuff, like any life. But there's a bigger movement. It's not as big as I'd like, but again, there's a group. I'm not a member of that group, but the CCC is important. There's a group called Freelancers Union that does some good work. There's a movement called the Don't Work for Free movement. There are people who are starting to get it. This is just much bigger than you or me, though.
Some people think that cities like Baltimore that haven't drawn, have a tradition here, but haven't drawn artists the way bigger cities have, San Francisco, New York, L.A., can do it because the cost of living is less and there's space available for living and for workspace. Thought I'd throw that in. Joe in Baltimore, we'll go to you next. Joe, thanks for calling Midday.
Thank you. My view of this is that Baltimore has a very rich community of artists and cultural institutions, and we have plenty of wealth in the town. You can see it everywhere. But I believe that there's been a steady decline in the civic leaders, a decline in civic pride that has been eroding for years and years and years. I mean, there's, for instance, at one time the Baltimore Sun had Bodine, a photographer, who everybody could look at and say, this is our photographer. And there was support at one point. The support isn't there anymore, and it's been a slow decline. It's not the money. I mean, you can look around and see that Baltimore has plenty of money. You can look at the, you know, look at the Inner Harbor. It's something else that's missing. Mm-hmm. The same thing that was that made Florence thrive during the Renaissance, or Rome, or Naples. That civic pride in the artists from the localities. It's not here, and it's not in many, many cities.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think you make a good point. It is civic pride in part, but it's not just that. And certainly, you know, you're right that the way, you know, the sort of Renaissance and medieval period, when you had you know, each duchy, you know, had a small symphony or an opera company, or would hire a painter to do portraits. You know, there was a sense that this was a way to announce the might and the sort of sophistication of the duke or whatever sort of tin pot leader there was. That was important. We don't have that anymore. But I think there's something bigger that goes beyond Baltimore's civic pride. I mean, I think we've, as a society, over the last few decades, sort of lost our faith in the arts. You know, we've lost our sense that this stuff matters, and that art, music, theater has something to do with the soul. That it's morally clarifying. That it has meaning and depth. And I do a chapter on this called Self-Inflicted Wounds. I originally called it Losing Our Faith. But the old sort of modernist idea that again, music, literature, and so on were windows to the soul or a vessel for our inner life, that they told us something about the human condition. I mean, when I use any of those phrases, I feel like I'm 80 years old. You know, it's a very old school way of looking at the arts and culture. It's one that I and some people I know, I hope, still have. But in the contemporary world, and this is not specific to any city, but the sort of Anglo-American world, art is about, and the coverage of art is about celebrity. It's about money. It's about PR. I mean, when's the last time you read a story in the mainstream press about a visual artist that wasn't about auction prices? That's not what art is about. Art is about something that makes us more empathetic, that deepens us, that kind of enriches our understanding of human life. It's not just about auction prices.
Yeah. And celebrity journalism. Journalism has kind of supplanted criticism.
Yeah.
We don't have our own film critic at the Baltimore Sun.
Right. Mike Schrago, who Baltimore was very lucky to have Mike Schrago, writer whose work I know well, to not have him is a major loss for the city and its film scene.
I think the discussion about changing media and compensation distracts from the main issues. This is John writing us by email. I disagree that our arts and culture are vanishing. I think arts and culture are evolving, and so are the media that artists use. What about these fields? Video game designers, animated filmmakers, website designers, artisan chefs, artisan brewers, tattoo artists, fashion designers, bloggers, and Scott, he has architects on this list, so gives you an opportunity to address architects as you do in your book. But what about, he says, all these fields are thriving and these fields are quickly growing.
Some of that's true. I mean, you know, I say this in the book. If you're into food and beer, things have never been better. I mean, I remember back when, you know, Canadian lager was considered a sophisticated beer. So things have gotten, and I've been to Brewer's Art a couple times. I mean, that's an incredible place. There's a craft beer revolution in California. Yeah, I mean, if that's what you value, if you're into fashion, beer, food, things are
getting
better.
Video games.
Yeah. But these other art forms, again, music, theater, independent film, if we include journalism in this, it's not doing so well. These things are important. They have been for hundreds of years. I don't think a video game tells us something about our soul. I think a video game can be smartly designed, handsome. I don't think it's the same thing. I really don't.
What's going on with architecture and architects? Just briefly.
Sure. Architecture lost about 30% of its employment in the 3 years after the 2008 market crash. Things have gotten a little better since then. It still continues to lose jobs. But there's been So what's happened there has been similar to what's happened in a lot of these other firms, is that despite the talk of how, you know, the internet and this sort of new economy was going to create this sort of alternative culture and give artists an independent perspective, you know, et cetera, what we've seen is a lot of corporate consolidation. I mean, small firms, there are a bunch of them in Los Angeles that were innovative and smart, and in some cases green and run by, you know, people who were in mid-career and weren't wealthy. Those firms have been crushed. What you have is architecture has come back, and again, this is a metaphor for the larger economy, the larger creative economy, is you've had big corporations get bigger. Overall, employment is way down. I don't discourage people from going into architecture. I think it's an incredibly important field, but you've got to have your eyes open to what's happened to it.
A call from Annapolis. Alicia, you're on Midday with Scott Timberg.
Hey, actually, I am from Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm calling from there today. We have a pretty strong arts community here. But, you know, our college, which used to be a small liberal arts college, has become a big university. What I wanted to say today, I'm really glad y'all are talking about this. I think it's a really big issue. From my own personal perspective, I consider myself very much a folk artist. I didn't go to school to study art, and I don't ever plan on becoming a famous artist like any of the artists that you mentioned earlier, Patti Smith and Lucinda Williams, who I love. But yeah, I think probably the most dangerous thing for people of my sort of genre are the quality of the day jobs. I think that day jobs are probably very necessary for people like me. And I think historically a lot of great art has come from people that have worked day jobs, worked as blue-collar workers. Hazel Dickens is a really famous artist from my state. And she moved to Baltimore, as you probably already know, to work in a factory with some of her siblings. And from Renaissance painters to blues musicians, there's been some amazing and really moving work.
And so you're saying that the day jobs that artists need to live aren't as interesting, don't lead to more art. That's a very interesting observation.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, I'll say. I mean, I love the blues. I love, you know, folk art. You know, folk artists, outsider art, et cetera. You know, I'd say two things. First of all, I think in a town like yours, or, you know, one of my best friends who was a painter in Los Angeles, he lived in Venice, which is sort of traditionally and used to be an artist community, and he just got crushed by the economy. He's in Asheville now. I think it may be Asheville, North Carolina. I think it may be, which has a big arts and music culture. I think it may be towns like that, and again, maybe parts of Baltimore, which is a more affordable city, where things will be able to thrive. As for day jobs, I mean, day jobs are important, always have been. Let me point out, even with the economy coming back, though, the jobs that are growing, the jobs that are being added to the economy are low-wage jobs. They're things like cashiers, fast food workers, middle-class and high-wage jobs are down by about a million apiece. The low-wage, sector has come back. I think it's, you know, those jobs are being added. You know, when we're seeing employment numbers tick up, primarily it's low-wage jobs. And if you're in a small town in West Virginia, that may be enough. I can tell you, in the traditional places where music, art have been made, the big cities, that doesn't really cut it.
David in Baltimore, you're up next on Midday. Go right ahead. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for this wonderful program, important discussion. I have a two-part question. One is, to what extent is the situation that your guest is describing in his book applicable in other countries? And two, I have heard from time to time that artists, fine artists, writers are more respected in a number of other cultures than they tend to be in the United States. And I wonder if your author agrees with that, and if there's a reason for it, if he does. Thank you.
Those are two really, really good and important and sort of broad questions. Let me be as succinct as I can. My book is really about the sort of, you know, what I call the Anglo-American world. I mean, Britain has always been sort of, you know, halfway between the U.S. and Europe. It's weird that it's not weird. I'm happy for it, but it's been startling to me how much interest I've gotten from people in Britain. There are reviews running this weekend, and people in Britain are posting on the book and so on. And you know, the U.S. is the most kind of relentless free market economy, and probably the most sort of technologically, you know, technology worshiping culture. Neil Postman, the social critic, called it a technopoly, where technology was replacing culture. So America, the States, is sort of the leading edge for the world that Britain and Europe represent. You know, we're sort of their California, if you follow me. So I think people in Britain are interested in this because they see that the wave has started to crash here and it's going to continue to crash there. To some extent, what I'm saying is true of the entire, you know, English-speaking world, Canada, Australia, et cetera, et cetera. Europe is, you know, there's enormous financial, economic pressures in Europe right now, unemployment, you know, the Eurozone is a mess. But Europe has Europe doesn't have the same kind of anti-intellectualism and sort of anti-art movement we have here. I mean, they have a longer, many more centuries of respect for the arts and music. Their identity as nations is tied up in it. And you didn't get the movement that rolled out of sort of Nixon, Agnew, Dan Quayle, Newt Gingrich, the movement that led to people who worked in culture to be dubbed the cultural elite, you know, which allows, you know, like a billionaire a military contractor in Northern Virginia or a hedge fund guy to look down on a jazz musician living in a little apartment or a newspaper reporter with a 20-year-old car and call them an elitist.
I don't find what you write about elitist at all. In fact, you go to great pains to write about the middle class working people in the creative class and middle brow art that makes art accessible to people.
Yeah, exactly. But we have in the States, as opposed to in Europe, this implication that if you're in the arts in any form, you're a member of the cultural elite.
Right.
And that's a different, that's a kind of nasty insult that doesn't exist in Britain and Europe in the same way.
I like that question and your answer to it. It makes me think of Charlie Hebdo and number of the number of and the respect for and the celebrity of the artists, the cartoonists. And look what's happened to editorial cartoonists in the United States.
Yeah, well, a lot of them have been laid off. And yeah. I mean, you know, the Paris killings really hits home for me. I mean, the way I entered the group I'm writing about, you know, the creative class, was as a high school kid in Anne Arundel County, where there was a satire magazine in my high school. It was a satire magazine on one side. If you flipped it over, it was a literary magazine, that short stories. And I went in there one day after school, I think as a freshman, and people were sitting around kind of dreaming up jokes and satire about things going on at the school, and I sort of slipped into it. And I realized, you know, between that and writing short stories, I think I won like a $15 award for some short story I wrote. This is what I want to do with my life. You know, it set me on this course. And the illustrator of the satire, of both sides, the magazine was called Impulse, and the satire side was called Repulse.
What school was it?
Severna Park High School. The illustrator was a guy who went to Maryland Institute and did my book jacket. You know, that's where I met or where
right.
I got to connect deeply with somebody who had become a lifelong friend. And
right.
and I realized these are my people.
One point you make in your work, in your book, is the work that goes on in newspapers over the years. That work has produced some great writers, not just for newspapers and magazines, but many of them have become novelists and screenwriters.
Yeah. I mean, Willa Cather, Hemingway, Garcia Marquez, all these people were journalists. And it served as a kind of apprenticeship, a way to teach them how to put sentences together, teach them how to see the world, gave them a way to travel and see things. So, yeah, newspapers connect in a deep way with this.
We're just about out of time, but I want Dave to ask his question. Go right ahead, Dave. Please be brief.
All right, I'll go quickly. I was just hoping your guest could comment on if we're losing some of the middle class, we're attempting to turn this situation around. While we're in that transition, we're going to have maybe this generation of people who aren't committed full-time to the work like they were in the past. How can we preserve some of these skills and talents and things, you know, during this time? What can we do to do that so that some of these really unique opinions and skills and artistic values and things like that aren't lost?
Yeah, good question. So very briefly, neighborhood things, you know, neighborhood initiatives help. But also, if you care about this stuff, buy a record, buy a piece of art, buy a book from a bookstore, support institutions, and support artists as best you can, because it matters, and they will be able to keep doing what they do if you and other people care about this stuff.
Scott Tinberg, who grew up here in Maryland, a former arts reporter for the LA Times, writes on music and culture and contributes to Salon and the New York Times. This is his first book. It's called, again, Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class, recommended by our staff here at Midday. Yale University Press is the publisher. Good luck to you, Scott Tinberg. If you're in Washington tonight, listen, is it tonight?
Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night. Scott's
Saturday
at Politics
night.
And Prose, an excellent bookstore and coffee shop in D.C. He'll be there at 6 p.m. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate it.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning in. That's our first hour, another hour of Midday Ahead. Please stay tuned.